Mike can see that people get those. A couple on the back seat over here and a couple back there. We tried to get them distributed. And I have a few here. Who needs one? Who needs a handout? Anybody? Everybody got one? Okay. There's a few. Well, everybody got quiet. I guess it's time to start. That's a good sign, isn't it? In this class, we're talking about the last part of Jesus' ministry. And we're going to pick it up in the 16th chapter of Matthew today. You might be turning in your Bible to that. The news is that the replacement projectors for the one that is somehow uncooperative lately. The replacement projectors will come tomorrow, and they will be installed this week, and next week we can work from the screen. But we'll work today from your Bible and the material that is handed out to you on the page that I've distributed. Those of you who are coming in late can pick up one off the back seat. I guess there's still a few back there somewhere. Get a handout or steal one from the neighbor when you sit down so that you can see what we're talking about. Now, we'll work from the Bible today as well. So be turning to the 16th chapter of Matthew. To set the stage for the story today, Jesus has just fed large numbers of people in two different settings. You might remember he fed 4,000 one time, 5,000 on another occasion. And how did the crowd react to this miraculous feeding of 5,000 people with just a few fish and loaves of bread and the 4,000. You remember what their reaction was? Pardon me? They were amazed and they were impressed that here was a leader who could feed an army. In fact, they were ready to make him king. And with unlimited resources like this, of course, this was not exactly the reaction Jesus wanted them to have. They thought he would be the perfect leader to lead them in a rebellion against the Romans. But he slipped away from the crowd, and you can read about that in the earlier chapters here. In the 16th chapter, as it opens up, we see the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And so we're going to talk about them for a little bit here. They came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. Now, there's an obvious implication there that they were aware that the crowds and a lot of people were suggesting that Jesus was the Messiah. And so these leaders, who are the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Talk about the Sadducees first. Generally, the Sadducees were the group that included the priests. And the Pharisees, generally speaking, were the teachers in the synagogues. And so they were both very influential leaders in the Jewish culture. And so they came to Jesus. Are they convinced that he's the Messiah? Well, they want him to give them what? What kind of a sign? What are they talking about here? Something miraculous, aren't they? But haven't they had a lot of miracles? Have they already seen a lot of miracles? So they're really skeptical somehow, aren't they? And so Jesus' answer in verse 2, he says, now you can see signs in nature. When evening comes, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, today it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast. There's a little poem that goes with that, isn't it, that sailors use, don't they? Anybody remember how that goes? Sailor's delight. And that's what he's saying here, isn't it? So that's just, does that always work? Suppose there have been some sailors trapped in stormy weather after that, because it wasn't exactly true, but it's a good approximation, isn't it? And so he says, you know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation looks for a miraculous sign. That's what they're looking for. But none will be given it except the sign of Jonah. Now, they had been told about this before back in the 12th chapter. And at the bottom of the first side of the page that you have, Matthew 12 and 38, they had asked him. The Pharisees had asked him, we want a miraculous sign from you. And so that's on your handout at the bottom of the page. A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign. He says the same thing here he said there, didn't he? None will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. So what is the sign of Jonah? 3 days. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. So that tells us some things, doesn't it? Jesus understood, and he's going to try to explain this to his disciples almost without any success at all, that he's going to be killed, and what's going to happen to him? He's going to be buried, and he will be in the heart of the earth for how long? 3 days and 3 nights, and then what will happen? He'll be resurrected, brought back to life. Now, we look at that concept and we say, well, that's pretty clear. But after the fact, we look at it and we don't look at it from the viewpoint of the disciples whom he's trying to explain this to. And so let's follow this through and see how he works on this project of trying to get his followers, the 12 apostles, really, to understand what all of this means. He begins in verse 5 here. Excuse me, I've got something in my throat this morning. When they went across the lake, the disciples forgot to take bread. Okay, so they didn't bring lunch. Be careful, Jesus said to them, be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Okay, that's the group up here that came and asked him for a sign, remember? They discussed this among themselves. Who's they? That's the apostles, the disciples. It's because we didn't bring any bread. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked, ye of little faith, why are you talking among yourselves asking or about having no bread? Do you still not understand? Don't you remember the 5 loaves and the 5,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? How many did they gather up? A dozen basketfuls of leftovers, didn't they? Are the 7 loaves and the 4,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? How is it that you don't understand that I was not talking to you about bread? Bread's trivial, isn't it? He can make bread. That's not what he's talking about the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But be on guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He repeats his warning. Then they understood that he was not telling them to guard against the yeast used in bread, but against the what? The teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. So what did they teach? Move on over to Matthew 22. Kind of keep your finger here. We're going to come back to Matthew 16 in a minute. But Matthew 22, and you'll get a hint of what their problem is. Beginning in verse 15. The Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap Jesus in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know that you're a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. They're kind of flattering him here, aren't they? You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. And they've been hurt by that, of course. They wish he would pay attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it, now, are they asking for a ruling here or just an opinion? Well, anything he says that they can trap him with is going to be written in stone, isn't it? Tell us then, what's your opinion? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? That's a problem with the Pharisees, isn't it? And they have some rulings about that sort of thing. But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. And they showed it to him, a denarius. And he asked them, whose portrait is this and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. And when they heard this, they were amazed. Now, why would that amaze them? Yeah, against the government. That's right. You don't want to pay taxes, do you? When they heard this, they were amazed. The answer doesn't give either one of them any comfort, does it? So they left him and went away. Now that's the Pharisees. What do you see in the Pharisees and their willing or trying to trap Jesus? What's their attitude? Well, let's look at the other ones, the Sadducees. That same day, the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection. Now that's a key verse I want you to remember, a key phrase, because that's a problem he's having with his disciples. Who say there's no resurrection came to him with this question. Teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and have children for him. And they go through this long discussion about a woman who had seven husbands, each of which died in succession. And along about the third or fourth husband, I think she'd have trouble finding anybody to marry. They all die. And now their question is what? When they get to heaven, if there's a resurrection, you see, they're going to throw a monkey wrench into the whole idea of a resurrection. Whose wife is she going to be in the resurrection? Well, and Jesus again says, you don't understand what? In heaven, we're not married. So it isn't an important concept. He just sort of disarms them with that. We're like angels. No, we're not angels. That verse is misunderstood in many ways because when you die, you don't become an angel. The angels were created beings at the beginning. But we'll be like the angels. The angels don't procreate. They don't marry. They don't have children. And you won't either. Well, all right. So the Sadducees have a problem, and the Pharisees have a problem. They represent two groups in that culture that were extremists. You can think of them in those terms. You could almost classify them by parallel with some people in our culture. Which one is more liberal, do you suppose? If you try to classify the Pharisees and the Sadducees as liberals and conservatives, who's liberal? Which ones? The Sadducees are liberal or the Pharisees? I hear some of both. And which ones are conservative, you see. Now we're talking about in our society, we would make a comparison. Suppose we talk about government. Which of the parties in our government is liberal, the Democrats or the Republicans? We have a quite divergent observation of what's going on, don't we? Generally, the conservative people are considered who want less government, and they don't always act that way, of course. Neither of these viewpoints is perfect, and of course the analogy isn't perfect either. But we say one group, like the Republicans are conservative and the Democrats are liberal, is the way that's generally looked at, but not everybody agrees with that evaluation either. But in their religion now, we're talking about the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Pharisees are trying to make everything much more complicated, you see, by adding rules and regulations to the basic law of Moses, whereas the Sadducees tend not to accept anything that isn't spelled out in strict detail. That's just one way of looking at it, and it's not the only way. But why wouldn't they accept the resurrection as reality? Why would they ask Jesus, not believing, it says clearly they didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. And so why did they take that viewpoint? And of course Jesus goes on to say God's not the God of the dead, he's the God of the living. These people all still live on this and another occasion. So what's their problem with a resurrection? Well, it isn't spelled out in the Old Testament in any great detail, is it? It's hinted at. And of course, the Psalms have some verses in them that Peter will quote on the day of Pentecost that God would not leave his soul in Sheol, that is in the grave, and it would not allow it to seek corruption. And so there are hints here and there about resurrection, but nothing spelled out in detail, and so the Sadducees just don't believe it. Yeah, there are some. It's just that they took that viewpoint that there's no resurrection. Now that's a problem for Jesus' followers. They're going to have to decide what that means. And so we'll see that as we go along here. Why does he call the viewpoints of the Pharisees and the Sadducees yeast? It's influence. Yeast has an influence. What does yeast do to bread? Do we have any cooks here in presence? I think we probably do. And when you make bread, you put yeast in the dough, and what does it do to the dough? It goes throughout the dough, and it's alive, isn't it? What influence does the yeast have on the dough? Does it make the bread taste different? It does. It has a slight change in taste. But the biggest difference is what? Change in texture and volume. Yeah. It makes the yeast rise. How does it do that? Well, it produces a gas. What gas does it make? Well, it actually makes two gases. But it makes carbon dioxide mainly, that causes the dough to swell up. And then when you cook it, it kills the yeast, of course, and there's a little bit of alcohol produced in the process as well. So it makes a difference in the texture of it, and it's an influence in the making of the bread, but it doesn't really add a whole lot to the bread. You could survive on unleavened bread as easily as you could on yeasted bread. Doesn't change the nutritional value of it much. And so it's not a whole lot of substance to yeast, but it does make things more pleasant in some respects. And so there's nothing wrong with yeast, but God chose not to use yeasted bread in the ceremonies associated with the Old Testament or the New. But so it's an influence. It's going to change things, but it doesn't add a lot of substance to the arguments. Now, I want you to see, as we go along, that the disciples, the apostles, have been influenced by all of this in their culture. The next thing in chapter 16, just kind of keep your mind on that idea about the Sadducees and the Pharisees. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked the disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Who said that? Who's they? Well, his disciples. And the way their discussions and teaching usually go, the teacher asks a question, they discuss it among themselves, and then the answer ultimately is given by the class captain, as it is. In this case, it's Peter. "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" And that's a plural there, "you" there. That's not a singular "you." And Simon Peter answered, and I think he's really answering for the whole group. We single him out as being somehow a whole lot smarter than everybody else, but I think he's reporting what their conclusion was. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven." And you're familiar with that verse as it goes on and discusses this. "I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. And so their answer to this was that he was the Christ. He's the Messiah. Everywhere you see the word Christ here in the Jewish system, that's the word Messiah. That's who they were looking for. And these apostles are going to be given considerable authority, as he has explained here. But now notice verse 21. "From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." Now, on this page that I gave you here, you'll find in Matthew three places where he does that, where he tells them that. This is the first one, 16:21. And in 17:22, he tells them again. And in Matthew 20:17, he tells them essentially the same thing. In Luke, there are three corresponding verses in the series of matters here where he explains to them. Let's turn over. Let's see what I want to look here. Okay, let's follow this one up first in Matthew 16:21. "He must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." And what's Peter's reaction to that? Peter took him aside. Now a student doesn't take his teacher publicly and complain about what he said, but after the class, as it were, he takes him aside and he says, "What? Never, Lord." Peter's prone to do that sort of thing, isn't he? When else did he say, "Never, Lord"? When they lowered the sheet in Acts, said, "Kill and eat"? No. He tends to react to these things that are against his concept. And so he says here, "Never, Lord, this shall never happen to you." What's not going to happen to him? What is there in that list of things that's going to happen? "Go to Jerusalem, suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." What word got his attention? Killed. Yeah. Once that word entered his head, he just cut him off at that point. Now you'll notice over here in that next one that's on your list, Matthew 17:22, when they came together in Galilee, he said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day he'll be raised to life. And the disciples were filled with what? Grief. Why were they filled with grief? About the resurrection? No, they didn't get to the resurrection. They heard killed, and that tore them up. And they didn't understand the resurrection part, did they? Obviously they didn't. We read that and we understand it, don't we? I think we do. That death's not the worst thing that can happen to us. That we will be resurrected. And so they are trying to assimilate a concept that's really foreign. They've never really understood that the way Jesus wants them to understand it. And it's going to take a while for him to get that across to them in a way that they can understand. And in fact, he works on that through these next few chapters, and we'll see how he does it. Jesus' reaction, this will never happen to you, back in Matthew 16. Jesus turned and said to Peter, out of my sight, Satan, you are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men. How do you think that made Peter feel? It kind of boxed him around the ears, didn't it? Called him Satan. Was Satan influencing Peter in some way? What do you think? He's blocked, isn't he, in understanding what Jesus is trying to teach. And so Jesus goes on in verse 24 and following, talking to them about the difficulties they're going to face. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever wants loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his own soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he's done. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste of death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And we center on that because we say, okay, the kingdom came within the lifetime of people that were there. But he's telling them, your life isn't as important as your soul, is it? And so if you have to give up your life to preserve your soul, would you do it? Of course. We look at that in hindsight and we see it easily, but it wasn't easy for them. All right, so Jesus is going to do some things to try to convince his disciples of the reality of what they're going to have to face. And that's not easy. Look at chapter 17. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Now here's only three of the apostles, right? Who is it? Peter, James, and John. And suddenly appears before them Moses and Elijah. What bearing does that have on what Jesus is trying to teach them? Well, Moses and Elijah are not, they're not dead. They're here. They've been what? They've been resurrected already, in some sense of the word. Now we look at, there's a problem we may have with that, and that we look at the great resurrection at the end of time, the great white throne judgment, and say everybody's going to be raised at one time. But what about these men who are here? Are they exceptions? How did Moses die? God took him, didn't he? He went up on Mount Nebo? And God transferred his robes to his son, and then he died. Or did he die? I think that the devil in Jude, it says the devil disputed over the body of Moses, and so the suggestion is that his physical body died. But here's Moses again talking to Jesus. Is it an illusion? Or is it real? What's going on here? And what about Elijah? Well, Elijah didn't die. He was translated, wasn't he? And in the sight of many of his contemporaries, and especially Elisha. So here they appear talking to Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He's going to build some little shacks there for them. I guess he expects they're going to stay there for a while. Or at least he wants them to, maybe. While he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son whom I love. With him I'm well pleased." What? Listen to him. Suggesting that what he has to say is more important than what Moses and Elijah had to say. Incidentally, what were they talking about? In fact, it says that in one of the parallel passages about the transfiguration, that they discussed the death that he would soon encounter. So that should tell his disciples, at least Peter, James, and John, that the resurrection is a real thing. Don't worry about so much about death. Realize that there is life after death. The Sadducees don't teach that. And so that's part of the yeast of the Sadducees. It's really got to be overcome. So when the disciples heard this voice from heaven, they fell face down on the ground, terrified, but Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said, "don't be afraid." When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. Hold your finger there and turn over to 2 Peter, the first chapter. Now, 2 Peter is over near the end of the Bible, almost before the book of Revelation. Second Peter 1, verse 16. "We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ," the Messiah, see, when he says Christ, "but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty, for he received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory, saying, 'This is my son whom I love, with him I am well pleased.'" So Peter's talking about what event? "We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain." He's talking about this event of the transfiguration, isn't he? Jesus received honor and glory and majesty by that event. "And we have the word of the prophets made more certain. And you will do well that you pay attention to it as a light shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. Above all, you must understand that no prophecy of Scripture came about by the prophet's own interpretation, for prophecy never had its origin in the will of man, but men spoke from God as they were carried along by the Holy Spirit." Now here's Jesus prophesying about his own death and resurrection, trying to get the idea across to his followers. Now there follows this event of healing of an epileptic boy down in the following verses. And Jesus rebuked the demon, and he came out of the boy, and he was healed from that moment. And they talked about the fact that the apostles had prayed on this occasion, but they couldn't drive out the demon. In verse 22, when they came together in Galilee, he said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised to life." And the disciples were filled with grief. Son of Man is whom? That's Jesus' title for himself, isn't it? And the disciples centered on that word, killed. There had been other messiahs. Did you realize that? Other men who claimed to be the Messiah. What would be the privilege of being the Messiah in that culture? If you came and said, "I'm the Messiah," would you receive any respect and honor, and could you collect any money for it? I could. And gain a following. And you read here and there, and especially in the writings of Josephus, that there were men who did that and they came to nothing. In Acts they talk about a case like that. It eventually fell apart and the followers were dispersed and it came to naught. So being the Messiah was an important sought after role. But you can't just take that upon yourself and be the Messiah. You have to be appointed, don't you, by somebody. Who appointed Jesus as the Messiah? God did on what occasion? On the occasion of his baptism by John the Baptist. There follows this little discussion about the temple tax. We talked about that. That's in Capernaum before they go to Jerusalem. They come to collect a tax, and the fact that Jesus and Peter are the only two individuals in that group who were over 20 years of age and owed the tax, it would appear. And that suggests that the rest of the apostles were still in their teen years. Now, then there was the discussion of who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, and as we follow that along, and then following some parables that came. But let's switch over to the story in John. In the Gospel of John. Let's see. In the 10th chapter of John. Begin around verse 22. Then came the feast of dedication at Jerusalem. Do you know what is the feast of dedication? It's Hanukkah. Yeah. Hanukkah celebrated an event that had happened a century before when the Syrians had desecrated the temple. Remember Antiochus Epiphanes? We talked about him in the past. And he butchered a sow on the altar of the temple. And they had to cleanse things after that, didn't they? And so it's celebrating the cleansing of the temple and the driving out of the Syrians. And for a while, the Jews ruled themselves after that event. So they celebrated this every year. It was winter. And of course, that agrees with their holding that event in at the beginning of winter. Jesus was in the temple area walking in Solomon's colonnade. The Jews gathered around him saying, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you're the Christ, if you're the Messiah, tell us plainly." And Jesus answered, "I did tell you, but you did not believe. The miracles I do in my Father's name speak for me, but you do not believe because you are not my sheep. My sheep listen to my voice. I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life. And they shall never perish. No one can snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all. No one can snatch them from my Father's hand. I and the Father are one. And when he says that, the Jews picked up stones to stone him. But Jesus said, I have shown you many great miracles from the Father. For which of these do you stone me? And we're not stoning you for any of these, replied the Jews, but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God. I and the Father are one. And so he goes on discussing that. And again, they tried to seize him, but he escaped their grasp down in verse 39. And now a critical thing. Then Jesus went back across the Jordan to the place where John had been baptizing in the early days. Where is that place? Where was John baptizing in the early days? It doesn't name it here, but it is named in the first chapter of John. So if you flip over there to John 1 and 28, you find out where that was. Where was it? All this happened at Bethany on the other side of the Jordan where John was baptizing, it says there. So you can kind of make a marginal note. He went back to Bethany. Here he stayed, and many people came to him. They said, though John never performed a miraculous sign, all that John said about this man was true, and in that place many believed in Jesus. So if you ask the question, did the Jews believe in Jesus? Well, some of them did, and some of them didn't. And those who had been followers of John particularly did believe, didn't they? But the ones in Jerusalem did not. So how is Jesus going to convince his followers about the reality of the resurrection? That's what he's faced with, because he tells them three times and they don't get it with his explanation. So he decides to do what's recorded in the 11th chapter of John, and that's our subject for next week. A man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. When he heard this, Jesus said, the sickness is not to end in death. No, it is for God's glory that God's Son may be glorified through it. Jesus loved Mary and her sister and Lazarus. Yet when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Can you imagine how difficult that was? And then he said to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. But Rabbi, they said, a short while ago, the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back there? And Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours of daylight? A man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. It is when he walks by night that he stumbles, for he has no light. And after he said this, he went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, and I'm going there to wake him up. The disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but the disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you may believe. Believe what? There's something they don't believe. The resurrection. But let us go to him. And so, although there's much in the death and resurrection of Lazarus that has meaning beyond this particular purpose, it's clear that Jesus did this. He had raised other people from the dead. Do you remember some of those occasions? The widow of Nain? Yeah, he met a funeral procession coming out of the city, and he touched the funeral bier, and the man sat up and was restored to his mother, a widow who had no other children. And can you think of some others that he raised from the dead? Jairus' daughter, I think I heard somebody say. And she had just died. The son of the widow of Nain had been dead for some hours. Any others? Think of any others that he raised from the dead? They knew he had that power, or they may have reasoned that these people weren't really dead. I don't know. But on this occasion, there's going to be no doubt about it, is there? And so we'll look at that. Read this 11th chapter for next week, and we'll talk about that. The resurrection, we tend to emphasize the crucifixion. But the resurrection is the key element of the gospel, as Paul explains it in Romans, isn't it? The death, the burial, and the resurrection are modeled by our conversion in baptism. So we'll talk about some of those things in coming time. Now I want you to also think about what's on the back side of your page here. Isaiah, 53rd chapter. We talked about that before. Could Jesus have known the things that were about to happen to him from the prophets in the Old Testament? That's a key question. Did he know this supernaturally, or was it something that he could, by reading his Hebrew Bible, understand what was about to happen to him and tell his apostles that this was coming? So we'll talk about that next week as we look at this resurrection description in the 11th chapter of John. Thank you very much.